Welcome to the 10K Collective, my friends. Now, look, if you're listening for hacks and short-term tactics, I'm afraid you are in the wrong place. Let me tell you about the 10K Collective Mastermind. First of all, its members meet in person. They know each other well. They all make over $500,000 a year. Several make several million a year. Many have doubled their revenue over the last 18 months. If you're that kind of person, then this podcast is made for you. Today's episode is sponsored by the new e-commerce podcast, The E-Commerce Leader. The podcast is hosted by yours truly and Jason Miles, multi-million dollar Shopify owner and Udemy's highest rated e-commerce instructor. If you're the owner of a thriving online business and you want to become the best e-commerce leader you can be, it's got your name on it. For free guides and mini courses on many topics, go to www.theecommerceleader.com. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome back to the 10K Collective podcast, which is a kind of sub-podcast these days of the amazing FBA collection. And the reason that I'm branding it as 10K Collective is because that is geared to the needs of six, seven, eight figure and beyond Amazon sellers and e-commerce sellers. And today's episode is no exception, that we're looking at quite high level stuff, but that even if you're not ready to sell your business yet, we're talking with a business broker or indeed merger and acquisition advisor, which may not be the same thing, which is a clue there into what we're going to discuss today. So we've got Chris Shipfling here from Global Wired Advisors, and I'm just taking some notes here. Experienced M&A advisors for digitally native enterprises. So Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
That's a pleasure. So where are you coming to us from today?
Charlotte, North Carolina.
Excellent. And I understand, yes, from our previous conversation with Jason that it's a very big center for financial services in the U.S. So,
yes. Yep. So we actually have two large industries here. We've got banking, so financial services and banking, and we also have NASCAR. It's the home of NASCAR.
That's quite violently different. Okay. So let me come back to the way that I introduced it. This is your sort of tagline: experience M&A advisors for digitally native enterprises. Now, even the sort of language you've chosen, that's about the most corporate sentence I've ever spoken on my podcast. You're not gearing yourself to the guy at the kitchen table business, are you? Clearly.
No, that's not necessarily that's not necessarily our ideal client. That's correct.
So M&A advisors, different from business broker, but let's dig into that. M&A, mergers and acquisitions. So what is the difference between an M&A advisor and a business broker then, as most of us would understand it?
Yeah, good question. I mean, there's a couple, probably I would say, key differences. You know, a experienced merger and acquisitions professional usually has a pretty strong background in investment banking. Investment banking, as you know, is a very high-risk, complex world. Lots of high stress. You have to make a lot of very important decisions and for very large type of financial transactions. And so typically that's probably one of the bigger differences, specifically to, I would say, this world, this Amazonian digitally native world, is that an M&A professional advisor is going to have a much more deeper and richer experience when it comes to investment banking versus a broker who typically has very little financial experience. They may have owned a business and sold that said business. And obviously going through that does give you experience, but it doesn't necessarily equip you with the right experience to call yourself a true merger and acquisitions professional.
So one of the things to say then is, which I think is linked with the corporate language that you've used, experienced M&A advisors for digitally native, like it in digitally native enterprise just sounds like you've just wandered into the boardroom. So presumably you are actually pitching to boardrooms of companies and tell us a little bit about the sorts of people you sell businesses to, or you help, you know, businesses sell to.
That's right. And I think that also is a good distinction as well between, you know, a quote unquote broker versus, you know, a M&A professional advisor. You know, an investment banking experience requires a different type of process. That process is much more thorough. It's very invested. And you're also doing a lot of research when it comes to your client, your client's business, and the future of that business and how it might work very well within either a private equity firm, a family office, and or a corporate or strategic buyer. So the types of folks that we're, you know, regularly speaking to, we do speak to individual buyers. So I don't want to sit here and say we don't ever speak to them. We have sold businesses in the past year to individual buyers as well. but we are on the phone quite regularly with private equity, global family offices. Family offices are just a fancy way of saying a family, a generational family that has lots of wealth, has built a fund or created a fund, and they're looking for active investments. And so that's effectively why they're called a global family office. And also corporate strategic buyers. For instance, one of the things that we do on a regular basis, we'll go visit trade shows. We'll go to some of the most important trade shows within certain verticals around the world. We've been to trade shows in Germany. We've been to trade shows in China. We've been to trade shows, of course, all across the United States. And one of the sole reasons of doing that is we are identifying corporate and strategic M&A arms or CEOs, CFOs that we know are attending these trade shows of larger businesses and sitting down with them and asking specifically, what is your criteria? What type of business are you looking to purchase or to bolt on as a strategic acquisition to continue to bring more value either to your shareholders or just bring more value to the business in general? And so we do the same thing with private equity and family offices. If we don't have something to sell them, it doesn't mean we're not actively speaking with them and trying to understand their criteria. That's a very active role that our distribution team does here at Global.
So you're in touch with a certain type of potential buyer then, by the side of it, private equity, global family, private office, corporate investors. So what kind of bits, so that's the sort of selling side, who you sell to. So what kind of businesses do you sell? I mean, is there like a minimum that you guys work with? Just trying to kind of work out who should and who shouldn't be approaching you guys, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a good thing to discuss, I would say. So, our firm has obviously evolved in the past year. Before we had a threshold very early on in our stages that we were really looking for anybody who had about $1 million in revenue and up. And over the course of the past 2 years, that has evolved specifically with Global Wired. And we've moved that threshold up, and it's for a reason. The reason why we moved it up is we're trying to make sure that when putting a business through our process, which is truly an investment banking process, it's a good fit for both seller and also Global Wired advisors as the intermediary. And typically what we have found is that businesses that have a bit more substantial revenue than what you're seeing in terms of deal flow from brokers, a little bit higher in call it enterprise value, revenue, or cash flow, it tends to fit our process a lot better. We're able to do and become more flexible. So a broker will take a business almost of any size, which is really interesting to me, whether it's a $19 million business or it's a $100,000 business, and they'll blast it out to a list that's been procured over the past several years. And while we do things a bit different. So while we have a list, it's going to be a much more segmented list that we're working from. And then also, we're going to go out and do lots of research to try and identify the types of counterparties that are going to care about the company. We had a deal that closed just last week. That's the other difference between us, I would say, us and other folks who are in the space. You'll see some of our deals on, I'd say a listing site, a BizBuySell or a BizQuest. But there are a lot of our deals that you'll never see. And we don't list any of our deals on a website. So a deal we closed last week, you never would have even known that we had the deal. We didn't send it out to a list. We procured our own list of research of about 80 different firms that we knew would care. And ultimately, it closed with a family office, and actually a billionaire's family office, which is pretty neat to say.
A billionaire family office. Wow. I mean, I guess what it comes down to is a match between the sort of business you're offering, the sort of person who's therefore likely to buy it, and then the person who's going to help that process work. I mean, it makes sense that it would be potentially different people would have different strengths in those areas. And what strikes me is that recently, for example, my wife and I bought a property that we've rented out. Touch wood, it's still rented, it's still paying the rent. And I went very consciously around the local estate agents to help, to which is like a real estate agent in the States, to help us get it rented out, because it's a pain trying to do that just occasionally for one-off properties. I've done it in the past. And I very clearly went to the places that had a high-end image, that had the sort of people literally on their lists, like you were saying, who worked for like Google, Facebook, or whatever, who have offices in London, and they relocate people and they'll pay top dollar and they'll get on with it quickly. As opposed to some other guys that I spoke to who have just a different set of people that visit because it looks different, it feels different. So it's just a question of matching the two sides up, isn't it? Who the sort of people that are looking for a certain size of thing that they want to buy or rent in that case, and the people that the asset that you're renting. I mean, if I did this, by the way, I've got a very small place that I rent out in Cardiff, which is a much less grand and much less expensive city. And if I put it with those guys, it would be a ridiculous mismatch. So it's not a question of better or worse. It's a question of matching the two up, right? So that's what strikes me. And, you know, okay, I'm not familiar with buying and selling businesses, but property is a bit more familiar, I guess, to most of us. So let's talk about then, which I know is related to this, one of your favorite topics and probably a favorite topic for all business owners is how valuable is my business? So I know that who you sell to and the way you position that business within that sort of entity's world can make a big difference. So tell me a bit about business valuations and multiples, because I know that's related to this question.
Yeah, great. I mean, it's absolutely a topic that everybody wants to talk about and talk through when it comes to acquisitions, both, you know, obviously buy and sell side. So, you know, it's interesting. And the way that we really approach valuation is a lot of it is from an art, a science. It's about risk versus return. And it's also about the maturity of the current industry. And so kind of boiling all that into one soup is really important to land on a valuation. And, you know, valuation is nothing more than a communication point on what a buyer believes is valuable and what a seller believes is valuable, and trying to meet somewhere in the middle, or potentially meet somewhere where the seller believes it needs to go, or where the buyer believes it needs to go. You know, a buyer says, I'm willing to purchase the business based on X amount of cash flow, and here's why. That's their valuation, right? So kind of boiled down, that's the definition of it. So how do you take the evaluation and get the gravitational pull away from where the market currently sits? You know, there's a lot of reasons why the market sits where it sits. One of it is just risk versus return, right? So looking at, say, and speaking to specifically your folks, an Amazon business, and they're saying, well, there's a lot of risk here. And a lot of times what happens in when you're looking at businesses of this size, you know, the market in general looks at all of these businesses as small. We don't look at a $50, $60 million business as small, but the market does. It's still small. And so there is this idea out there that just because you have a smaller business, it's now more vulnerable. And it's vulnerable, therefore, I don't want to pay as much. And so when it comes to valuations and really doing a good job of gravitationally pulling someone to a higher valuation for the company, there's a lot of detail that goes into and positioning that goes into making sure a potential counterparty truly understands what they're buying with this business. So you do a risk versus, you do an what we call it an ROE or a return on equity or a risk versus return analysis for the buyer. You walk them through the art and the science of the company. Where is this business going to be in 3 years? You know, if you just sit there and perform a second grade or a grade school exercise and just list off marketplaces that this business could potentially sell in, it's lazy. It's just pure unadulterated laziness. And so when you're applying a process like ours to your business, to your company, you know, part of the prep, part of that offering is diving in and really painting the 3-year picture business plan of where this is going. In my former life, I had to sit in a boardroom and I had to present once a year my individual 3-year business plan, sales and marketing plan for my units that I managed for this one company in particular that I worked for. It was a middle market business. You know, in other businesses, they were small. Every October, September, we went through a very large forecasting exercise. And that forecasting exercise, you went through everything and you came up with a budget based on a forecast, based on a marketing plan. And all of those things became defendable and, you know, I call it an offense and defense playbook for why we believed we were going to achieve the things we were going to achieve. It's the same thing when you're putting a business to market. You know, when you're speaking to private equity, when you're speaking to family offices or corporate strategic buyers, or even an individual buyer, doesn't matter. You need an offense and defense playbook because you need to be able to defend something and you need to be able to go on offense about why this business in particular is worth more and should index higher than other businesses that are trading lower. It's also, you know, and I'll end with this point. It's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy that's happened in this space as well. We've noticed that since pretty much the beginning of when we started to trade in the space. you have folks who have gotten very fat and happy. And so the process they're running is making them money. Why would they change their process? They don't need to. But this industry is growing up and there's more sophistication that's coming into this space. And buyers who are sophisticated are looking for something a little bit more, I would use the word grown up, but we'll use the word professional when it comes to the way the businesses are being positioned and the way that they're being offered in the marketplace.
That all makes a lot of sense. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that as Amazon has exploded into public awareness, and you know, Jeff Bezos at some points anyway has been and probably will be at the time of listening to the podcast, the world's richest man. Everyone's become aware of it, and the space has changed so much since I've been podcasting about it 4.5 years. Mm-hmm. And that professionalization, I mean, I got away with just chucking stuff out there for a few months and somehow I've gained some kind of audience. If I tried it again in the same way, it would be a fraction of the audience because the space has changed, as you say. And that self-fulfilling prophecy thing makes a lot of sense as well. I mean, if this is, I guess, to come back to the real estate analogy, because I understand it. If I'd got this house that was helping to rent out for about £2,000 a month, or $2,500 a month, if I'd gone to, say, if I'd removed two or three of the wealthier agencies that had literally people on the books who would get shipped around the world by their company, you know, there was less price resistance there. It probably would have chopped the price I could get down to, you know, maybe $2,000, maybe a little bit more. So a substantial difference in the value of the asset in terms of its cash flow to me anyway. I guess, you know, private residential property isn't valued as a multiple of cash flow. You know, commercial property is. So that's where the analogy breaks down. But in the other words, it who is out there selling the value of a property does seem to make a difference in that, even in that simple way. So tell me a little bit about multiples then. We've talked about that. And I guess in a way that multiples is a kind of lazy way of seeing the value of a business. My understanding is that the Harvard Business School has like literally 20 ways of valuing a business or something.
Oh yeah. Myself and my partners, if we could do a completely separate business school style podcast where we walk you through, yes, many, many different ways where you come to evaluation. I mean, you know, we were just talking about this the other day in the office. One way of doing it is how much revenue does each employee bring to the business? Okay, let's take those revenue per employee. There's, you know, there's top line revenue when it comes to certain service businesses. There's, you know, cash flow, there's discounted cash flow. Yes, there's a lot of ways to slice it. And in this particular space, there's a valuation on effective cash flow or SDE, seller discretionary earnings. We work in a lot of EBITDA, you know, with the type of companies that we work with, or adjusted EBITDA. And then there's a multiplier that's applied to that. Typically, in what's been done is comp, right? You'll just see them listed on websites and listing sites, 4 multiple, 3.5 multiple, 3.1, 2.8. And I guarantee you that if you really pressed the selling agent on why they came to that conclusion, my guess is you would come up pretty anemic and short on a very intelligent answer.
Yeah, that could be the case. I'm like, I guess a lot of the time, a lot of the works in the world seems to be done by monkey see, monkey do. So people copy each other. And unless you have a different way of operating, then I guess in the end, it's a bit hard to do that. So comparables, I mean, estate agents do the same thing. I mean, I guess, you know, they'll see a flat down the road that sold for $2,000 a month rent, and then somewhere that looks similar, but a bit smaller, that's maybe $1,800. And they'll look at your flat and go, well, it's about $1,900. And that makes sense. If you're dealing with something simple, like an apartment, and you can look at it, you can measure it, you can see pretty much most of the stuff you need to know right now.
That's right. It's much easier when it comes to real estate. That's right.
Yeah. So there you go. Whereas if you apply that sort of same thinking to something which has got a lot of moving parts, and what strikes me is this, I mean, even in the real estate market, okay, you need to move your employee across the world from Texas, which as is the case with one of our tenants, then okay, you're going to pay a little bit more because there's a corporate behind it. But that's really, really different from if I sell shoes and my biggest competition on Amazon and on the line is also sell shoes. If I remove them from the market, then I can up the price of everything I sell in the shoe market. So that the value of that business to me is astronomically greater than somebody who's just buying another business. So that there's a whole different thing, isn't it?
Here's what you just did, Michael. You just created what we call nuance. And there's a lot of that happens when it comes to valuation. I mean, there's truly an art and science to it. And, you know, I'll give you two great examples. You know, we sold a SaaS business recently and it closed, and that business, we just knew it was very special. You know, I can't disclose many things about it, but I'll just leave it. It was a very interesting business. We knew it would be an interesting business for a lot of potential acquirers. And that business in particular got a 12 multiple because we were able to position it the right way and present it to the right capital who understood the true value. And again, we didn't place a price tag on that. You know, another business that we sold last year was a business that was able to achieve an 8 multiple. Another one that didn't have a price tag, but it had so many elements to it that we positioned it in a way that this private equity firm, they got it. They understood why they're paying up. They understood why they're paying what they're paying. And in both of those instances, we gave guidance on the valuation, but when you're presenting to sophisticated capital, that's the other difference. They know how to do valuations because that's their whole job. So, you know, we let the trade, we let the market tell us what they believe intelligently, what it's worth. And it's really interesting, just so you know. You'd think you'd be able to take a, you know, like a dartboard and it just lands everywhere. When you're dealing with sophisticated capital, those darts tend to fall around the same place. It's really interesting to see.
You've got a consistency. And I guess that the unless they all went to the same business school and all know each other and went to the same frat houses or whatever, I guess then you could argue there's a bias in the valuation. But nevertheless, when multiple people independently come to the same conclusion, that's a lot more reassuring, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I want to ask them, this is a bit like the bit on Antiques Roadshow, which is a TV program we had in Britain and like, it's probably still going.
Yeah, we have.
When you come across that, it's probably been franchised around the world. So you basically, so you turn up with your, you know, ancient widget from home, maybe it's a piece of crockery or a painting, and then everyone's talking about this stuff. And then they go, yeah, we'll wait for the moment where they tell you how much is my business worth. So I guess, you know, you talk about some lovely valuations there, 12x, 8x. With an Amazon business, is it not the case that it's just 3 to 4x multiple is about right? Or is that incorrect thinking?
No, it's right. And again, a lot of it is the self-fulfilling prophecy that I spoke about earlier. And so, you know, when you have a buyer that's looking at a lot of Amazon-based businesses that are listed and they're listed for a multiple, it can present a challenge to get them to go higher in multiple. Now, we have done that before. Our multiples are indexing higher where brokers typically trade. But yes, I mean, the highest Amazon trade, I think, to date, and this could have changed because, you know, data is just very weak in this space. You have to go hunt, and you have to hunt pretty hard, as you know. It's still a cottage industry. But from what we've heard, it was about a 5.125 multiple, and that was a very large trade. I think it was like a $25 or $30 million business at the time. But, you know, I heard of another business in this space that was $45 million that traded for a 3 multiple. I guess I don't understand that because, yes, you actually can, the higher the EBITDA, and this is what we found, the higher the EBITDA, you can get folks, you can get private equity and sophisticated capital to believe and bite a little bit harder, even though it's purely Amazon. And again, as the calendar dates peel off, as the years peel off, as the earnings are published from Amazon, and it just continues to rip and tear through the market, it's a $1.1 trillion market cap right now with, I think, about 40 times current earnings. You know, if Amazon, the place where everyone's looking as a risk downside, is getting that type of multiple from their earnings, you know, why is it? And this is going to happen. Jason alluded to it, you know, in the previous podcast. It's starting to happen where I do believe that multiples are going to start going up because you're starting to get more sophisticated capital. And also, I would say a firm like ours is presenting deals in a more sophisticated way, which will absolutely help bring it up. To answer your question directly, actually, the average is lower. The average, you'll hear 3 or 4 as it being marketed, but the real trades are happening under 3. And typically around 2.6, 2.8, somewhere around there.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the sort of multiples I've come across from my friends selling Amazon businesses. Yeah.
And that's not where we trade. We've traded much higher than that when it comes to Amazon businesses. That's why I alluded to we are indexing higher multiples versus our competition. I mean, it can get a little gummy, as we like to say. It gets a little sticky when, you know, you do a really good job of positioning the company, but you will have a buyer still. And I think I heard this in a previous podcast that you did with a broker, and how he mentioned how buyers will point towards the risk downside. And I agree with that point. I 100% agree with what he said. You know, my counterpoint to that is that's really where I think you start to see that bifurcation between the broker versus an M&A professional process, because while a broker might point to a couple different points on the board of why they shouldn't think that way, we do a much deeper and richer analysis to try and point them towards future growth and a much different, I would say, view or perspective of the business to try and pull that multiple up.
Well, I guess in the end, it's all about a risk reward ratio, right? So even if you can't reduce the risk because that is accurately priced, I mean, there is a substantial suspension risk, not to mention that COVID-19 has shown up a risk that we didn't think was a thing before, which is Amazon could suddenly say, oh, well, we're not going to ship your products into FBA anymore. Thanks very much. Or yes, we're going to fulfill them, but it's going to take us 5 weeks. And yeah, these are strange times, but it sort of the extremes show up what was endemic in the system anyway. So that's another risk.
That's right.
On the other hand, though, the side of it that I guess you can talk up a lot and explain and quantify is the reward side, right? So the reward can be considerably bigger than, you know, a lazy analysis would give, I guess, then, you know, the risk reward's still better than it was and the multiple's still higher. Is that more or less a summary of what you were saying?
It is, yeah. It is. And I think it's all about positioning the company. I mean, again, it goes back to that offense and defense playbook, and it's more than just putting a bunch of really pretty things inside of an offering memorandum, which is what we do. You know, we put together an offering memorandum that and marketing materials that you would be very proud to walk into any Fortune 500 boardroom and slap it down on the beautiful mahogany, you know, $80,000 to $100,000 very long desk. But it's more than that. It's being able to articulate to the buying world why they should care about where this business is going when it grows up and how it fits wonderfully inside of whatever else they're doing. But that comes with a lot of research. You have to understand what else are they doing? And if you just show up to the table with a piece of paper and say, hey, this is a good business, you should look at it, do you want me to get this owner on the phone? It's just not enough. It falls so short when it comes to trying to achieve larger goals for the seller.
Which does make sense. In the end, sophisticated deals require sophisticated research, I guess, like anything else.
Of course.
Listen, we better start to bring this to a close because obviously this is a huge area. But the first thing to say is if people want to speak to you or Jason, I know we had on the last podcast, just remind them where they should go and, you know, what you can offer.
Yeah. Come to Global Wired Advisors. Just put it in Google for the 10% of you who use Bing. You can do the same. And for the 3% who use Yahoo, do the same. So just type in Global Wired Advisors. We're number one on all platforms. I haven't checked Yahoo recently, but click there and make your way towards a consultation. We are happy. You know, we obviously value our time. Clearly, we value your listeners' time. But we love to be very educational and we love to be as informative as we possibly can to get your viewers, your listeners, a really good view and perspective on what that looks like to take their business to market. And really, we call that, you know, sometimes it's just a barometer call is what I call it, right? It's just take kind of testing out where are they right now? Where's my business right now? And I mentioned earlier about that intersection. That's a great call for the intersection. To really kind of understand where are you in that intersection and where do you need to go. We're very resourceful too. You know, this is something we didn't talk about on this call, but we have a lot of resources to help you not only grow, they're vetted resources. We're not going to hand you a sheet of paper that's got, you know, 20 digital marketing firms to overwhelm you. We have one that we work with that has been vetted by us through a process of where we vetted many. And we trust them. We've introduced them to a lot of different people and the success rate has been very, very high. But it just doesn't stop there. You know, we've got Amazon consulting firms that we've vetted, et cetera, et cetera. So we're resourceful and we're happy to be very resourceful and share all those resources on a consultation call if that's something that needs to be done.
That's really great. And I think that's very valuable. Sometimes I have a similar thing when I have a consultation call with a client and they'll say, you know, I really need to solve a problem with my finances, but our accounting isn't up to scratch. Or, you know, do you have the number for a really great freight forwarder in you know, the US that deals with China importing?
Yeah,
and it's passing on
right.
Those people who you really trust because you've had a deep conversations and you've passed the clients
right.
On to them and they seem to have done a good job. So yeah, being at the center of resources is useful. So that sounds like another reason that people should get in touch, give you a call. Well, listen, we better start wrapping it up. So any last sort of words on the business of choosing who to work with to try and sell your baby, that is your Amazon business?
Yeah, look, there are great brokers that are out there, and I think they fit a really specific process. And, you know, to your point about, you know, when it comes to a certain type of client, when it comes to a certain type of business, and they're looking to achieve a specific type of goal, and they're very serious about selling their business, we would love the opportunity to speak to those types of companies, because we know that our process is going to be a decent, or excuse me, wrong choice of words, a very good fit, not just decent, but a very good fit for their transaction. So yeah, I'll end with that. You know, my intention here isn't to sit and disparage any business brokers. The point is just to let your listeners know that there is a clear difference between using one process over the other.
Great. Well, thank you for the clarification. It's always interesting to take multiple looks at the same problem as well. And I think that if nothing else, people should, I keep encouraging people to talk to business brokers. And I, you know, it's not because I expect to make any money or that the brokers will immediately. But what I do think is that the sooner you can start looking at your business as an asset that's potentially sellable, the quicker you're going to start thinking of it in a really business-like structured way. And I think the whole process is just vastly healthy for your business.
It is. So, you know, no, it absolutely is. We 100% agree with you.
Yeah. So you know, I would suggest that everybody listening that's got a serious size business that's somewhere within the ballpark is about sort of $1 million revenue that you have. I know a lot of people who've got that. It's not so hard to achieve on Amazon these days. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's not an unusual number. So I would urge anyone in that sort of ballpark, get in touch with these guys and get a perspective from outside of your business, if nothing else. So
we agree.
Chris, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your thoughts. Very interesting stuff.
Michael, thank you. Awesome.
Thanks so much for listening to the 10K Collective podcast, part of the family of amazing FBA podcasts. Today's episode is sponsored by the new e-commerce podcast, The E-Commerce Leader. The podcast is hosted by yours truly and Jason Miles, multi-million dollar Shopify owner and Udemy's highest rated e-commerce instructor. If you're the owner of a thriving online business and you want to become the best e-commerce leader you can be, it's got your name on it. For free guides and mini courses on many topics, go to www.theecommerceleader.com.